Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program investigating the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, the hopes we have for our children's well-being, financially and otherwise. I'm Richard Wolff. I'm your host on this program. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I teach currently at the New School University in New York City. I also write economic analysis and columns for a variety of publications, and in particular for truthout.org. That is a remarkable, independent, courageous website of economic and other kinds of social analysis every day. Check them out at truthout.org. Finally, I want to invite you, as I always do, to take a look at the two websites that we maintain that carry this kind of analysis and news that you hear on this program, together with classes and lectures and a whole raft of materials we think you will find interesting. We update it on a continuous basis, both of them. The first one is rdwolf.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites are available to you 24/7 at no charge whatsoever. And both of those websites give you two further capabilities. First, you can communicate to us what you like and don't like about the program, questions you'd like us to address. We read everything you send to us and use your comments to shape these programs. And therefore, we appreciate your sending them to us. Please understand we get many more than we could possibly answer in terms of each one, but we read every one and we use them to shape what we choose to analyze on the program. And finally, both websites give you the ability to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, ways to keep in even closer touch with the kinds of work we do. And again, I want to thank you, as I did last week, for your very kind comments and emails about my appearance on the 25th of July in the opening segment of Bill Maher's real-time television program, where he interviewed me on topics of the sort that we deal with in greater detail on this program. I was honored and flattered by Bill Maher's invitation, and your response has been more honorable and more flattering to me still, and I just want to say thank you. Okay, let's jump then into our updates for August 2014. An article in Bloomberg News Service, not a source that most folks would question, about the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, and how they overpay for everything. The article appeared in a Bloomberg Businessweek website, July 28th, the author Charles Kenny, K-E-N-N-Y. It begins by talking about the F-35 Lightning II Joint Strike Fighter. It announces that this fighter is coming in 40% over the budget that was allocated to it when it was agreed to proceed with this program. This is the latest attack. I'm reading from Mr. Kenny's story. This is the latest setback in the development of an aircraft that's already cost $400 billion with a B. A recent Government Accounting Office report noted that the cost estimates for operating and supporting the F-35 fleet are now more than $1 trillion, which even the Department of Defense officials have deemed, quote, unaffordable. It is, however, continuing. Pentagon procurement, he writes, is also running amok elsewhere. And what does running amok elsewhere mean? Give an example. Payments were made to the Bell Helicopter Corporation for gears at $8,124 each. That was 18 times the expected cost in the initial budget of $445. The article goes on to give many, many examples of particular items, large and small, some costing as little as $7.49 is what you can buy these things for in the open market. The Department of Defense spent $29.95. In one case, a crown coupling that cost $435.79 on the market cost the Department of Defense $7,399. The article itself in Bloomberg Business Week makes the point that it is completely out of control. One of the statistics that struck me was the following, that the Pentagon buys drugs from drug companies for military personnel. According to the GAO office report, government accounting office that monitors these things, it compared the net prices across a sample of 78 common and expensive brand name and generic drugs. And then it compared how much the Department of Defense paid for these drugs and how much Medicaid, the government program to help poor folks with medical care that they need, compared what Medicaid paid for the exact same drug that the Department of Defense purchased. On average, the Department of Defense paid 60%, 60, more than Medicaid. Something is terribly wrong. And when people complain about the government spending more money than is necessary, you'll notice that the conservative folks who make those kinds of complaints usually pick everything other than the defense budget. But here's the government itself monitoring the Defense Department and discovering that it is wildly out of control in its overspending of our tax money. The next item has to do with statistics about mortgage loans. The statistics on mortgage loans have shown that the housing market is not in too great shape, to say the least. But it has shown that there have been surprising continuity of money lent for mortgages, from which many commentators seem to have concluded that while it's not as much of a rebound as we would like, the housing market is okay. Not so, says another report from Bloomberg, written by A. Leondis on the 29th of July, which makes the obvious point that mortgages have become harder, not easier, for first-time home buyers to get. That's working-class people, middle-class people. The mortgages that are showing the statistics keeping them up are the big mortgages. They're called jumbo mortgages, usually mortgages in excess of $400,000, which is more than the average value of a home in the United States in the last few years anyway. Long and short of it, the only reason mortgages don't show a bigger shortfall in terms of any kind of claim that there's a recovery going on is because the richest amongst us are getting mortgages. Everybody else isn't. That's the reality behind the phony claim of an economic recovery. Next update has to do with bad loans. We all know that the crisis that exploded on this country in 2007 and 8 started with what were called subprime mortgages. That were mortgages that were given to people without checking properly that they had the wherewithal to pay them back. Mortgages often pushed on people who didn't understand their terms by banks and others eager to make a killing off of packaging these loans into mortgage-backed securities and so on. How interesting it is, then, that we discover that in the last couple of years, subprime auto loans have been blowing off the charts. That is, banks across America, local banks using money given to them by the big market center banks, the biggest banks in America, are pumping out loans to people for cars, to people who can't afford them either, and then packaging up and giving them to investors. And that there's growing worry among folks at the Federal Reserve and elsewhere that we're going to have a comparable collapse in the car loan business that would have serious economic repercussions. Not the same as the mortgage crisis, because the total money involved in mortgage lending is much, much larger than the total amount of money involved in auto lending. But it does go to show that banks haven't learned any lesson, that the Dodd-Frank bill and other reforms of our financial sector have not touched the basic drive of corporations to make money, making risky loans, and then hoping that the investors will take the hit or the government will come in and bail them out with our money. You don't change a system, and the system keeps chugging right along. We don't talk about system in this country. We sure don't confront the system, and we do not explore alternative systems, so we're condemned to live with the results of this system. Next update. This has to do with the minimum wage. Of course, I support an increase in the minimum wage. I have spent many hours on this program comparing the minimum wage in the United States with countries like Germany and England, where it's much, much higher, and other countries in Europe where it's higher still, Australia, where it's still higher, and so on. And so I support the rising minimum wage. But I do want to say something that has to do with system analysis of the sort I was speaking about a moment ago. To demand a higher wage leaves the system in place. Really, all it's doing is saying, look, I'm not going to talk about the system. I just want the folks at the bottom of this system to do better than they're doing. Give them more. Don't give them $7 X as a minimum wage. Give them, as President Obama suggests, $10.10, or as the militants among the fast food workers are pushing for these days, $15 an hour. And so give them more. And while I support that, that, in my judgment, is not a solution to the problems we face in this country. It will not fundamentally change the grotesque inequality that gets worse each day. It does not alter the behavior of major corporations in the fundamental ways they go about doing business. And therefore, I do not think it addresses the problems of the United States at the level of the system, which is where they lie. And let me give you a historical parallel, which I find very instructive. When the United States finally, after many, many decades of tolerating and indeed allowing slavery, the slavery mostly of Africans, to grow in the United States in our early history, when finally the opposition to that became strong enough so that you had real sizable social movements against the continuation of slavery in the independent United States, those two movements that developed were very different on just this point. One movement was in favor of giving a better quality of life to the slave, raising the food that would be provided to the slave, preventing the slave from being beaten, preventing the slave from being separated from his or her family. In other words, this movement wanted to improve the economic and other kinds of well-being of the slave. Much as today, the movement for a higher minimum wage wants to improve the conditions for those at the bottom of the wage scale. And of course, well-intentioned people supported that. But there were another group of people who said, no. The problem of slavery isn't how poorly the slave is treated. The problem is that he's a slave. The institution, the system of slavery has to go away. We have to go beyond it. We have to put it behind us. If all you do is get a better deal for the slave, but you leave him as a slave, you also leave the slave master in the position to take away or to take back what you have even won now if you get something. That shouldn't be. It shouldn't be that the well-being of one person depends on the whim and the will of another. That's what democracy is about. And if we don't want workers today to be at the whim of an employer, with workers the majority and employers the minority, then a minimum wage is the least of what we need. We need to change a system so the majority are not dependent on wages given or not by a minority. Okay, one last update before we turn to one of the major topics for discussion today. And this has to do with a report that came out last month from the Urban Institute, a well-respected research and advocacy organization in the United States, the Urban Institute. And they issued a group of reports, but two of them had the title that caught my attention. The first one was Debt in America, and the second was delinquent debt in America. And these were reports, short ones, that you can find at the website of the Urban Institute, that give us an idea of the scope and extent of debt in the United States. I found it striking, and I think you will as well. So let's begin with the bluntest one about debt. The average debt of an American with a credit file, that is an American who has a record of how he or she has managed their credit, the average debt in September of 2013, that's where all these statistics go, so they're a few months old. The report was just issued recently, but the data that the report was based on come from September 2013. Average debt of an American with a credit file, $53,850. That's the average. For those who have a mortgage, people who own their own homes, their debt, average debt, was $210,000. For people without a home, who didn't own a home, their average debt was $12,000. According to the records examined of credit files and so forth by the Urban Institute, somewhere between 15 and 20% of Americans carry no debt. In other words, a tiny minority of Americans are able to live without debt. The vast majority of Americans carry debt, and the average debt is over $53,000. To give you a sense of what that means, the median income in the United States of a household, and a household is presumed on the average to be two adults and two kids. If there are two adults, it would mean that the average debt of each of them, $53,000, would have to be doubled. You're adding mom and pop, or the two adults in the household. You are talking $107,000. The median income, that is 50% of American households, earn a total of $51,000 or less. So let's do it again. Half of the households of America earn $51,000 or less. And half, or the average, it's not quite the same as the median, but the average debt is $107,000. You get the picture? Debts exceed. The average household's debt is greater than the annual income of that household. And for many, many households, it's much, much greater. How much security can you have if the debt you carry is way more than the total annual income of both adults in the household? Other report, delinquent debt, I found this even more impressive. 35%, that's more than a third of people who have debts, have something called debt in collections. That means their debts are way past due. It's not that they've missed by a week or two. They've missed by months, so that the creditor to whom they owe the money has passed it on to a collection agency or another kind of company that hounds you to pay your debt. A third of Americans have debts in collection. Another 5% have what's called debt past due. That means they haven't paid for 30 days, but it's not yet to the point where it's given to a collection agency. Here's another documentation that we haven't recovered in this society. We have huge debts, way beyond what people can really carry, and the proof is how many of them are behind and are being dunned by collection agencies. Okay, let me turn then to one of the major topics that I want to drive home. I have done this before, but so many of you have sent me emails on this topic that I wanted to begin my first major topic discussion by giving it a short go-around, because I don't want to repeat myself for those of you that have understood it clearly already in the past. This has to do about property taxing in America. Does the government tax our property? Now, please help me be clear with you. I'm not talking about taxing our income. The federal government taxes the income we get week by week, month by month. Many states tax income. Some cities, like New York, tax income. I'm not talking about that. That's called the income tax. There are also things called the payroll tax. That also taxes your income, the money you get by being on the payroll of an employer. That's a tax on your income. I'm not talking about that. And I'm not talking about sales taxes, money you pay in the tax when you buy something, an article of clothing, a toaster, an automobile, and so on. Those are sales taxes. I'm talking about a different kind of tax. It's called the property tax. It's a tax you have to pay because you own something. And the tax says if you own such and such an object worth such and such an amount of money, you have to give one or another branch of the government a payment each year, which is a tax on the value of the property. Do we have property taxes in the United States? The answer is an unambiguous yes, we do. By far the most important property tax is not levied by the federal government, which does not tax property hardly at all. And it's not a tax levied by the states. They don't do much of it either. Incidental. The major government level that taxes property in the United States is the local government. The government of your town, your village, your city, maybe in some cases your county. That's where we have a property tax. Okay, what is the property that cities and towns tax? The only really important property tax we have in this country is levied by the local government. They tax mostly land, buildings, homes, automobiles, and boats. That's basically it. Those of you who own your own home know that you get a tax bill from the community in which your home is located, typically once or twice a year, and that you have to pay a property tax, such and such a percentage of the value of your property. Okay? So if you earn money as a working person, you pay an income tax on your income. And in addition, you pay sales tax when you buy things. And in addition, you pay property if you own property that is taxable, such as a land, a building, your home, an automobile, a boat, and so forth. Why do I bring this up? Because there is one kind of property that is not subjected to any kind of significant property tax by anybody, not by the local government, not by the state government, and not by the federal government. What property is that? Property in the form of stocks, bonds, cash that you hold. I want to drive this home to make sure everyone understands it because your questions show a great deal of interest in this topic. Okay, here's how it works. If you own a home, let's say for $100,000, you will be required to pay a property tax to the community in which this home is located. If you sell the home and use the $100,000 you got to buy shares of stock, so you still have $100,000 of property, it's just not in the form of a home, it's now in the form of stocks and bonds, your tax bill to your local community is zero. You don't own any more tax. There is no property tax on property held as stocks and bonds. Why is this important? Because the amount of wealth in the United States owned in the form of stocks and bonds is in the many, many trillions of dollars. That property is not subject to tax. If the owners of stocks and bonds had to pay a property tax on that wealth, just like they now have to on whatever wealth they hold in the form of a car or a boat or land or a home or a business building, well, then the revenue, tax revenue coming into the government would be hugely larger than what it is now, and all the talk about deficits would be gone in the snap of a finger. And now, of course, the explanation. Who owns the bulk of stocks and bonds? Answer, the richest people in America. Stocks and bonds are very unequally owned. The top 5 or 10% own the overwhelming bulk of property in the form of stocks and bonds. They get away with financial murder. They don't pay tax. And that's because they have the political power to make sure that the property tax in this country only affects the property of some. And who is that? The average American lucky enough to have a car or a home that they own. They have to pay a property tax. Those with the stocks and bonds don't. Was it always that way in the United States? No. Throughout our history, there are plenty of examples of states and communities that have, for various reasons and for various pieces of time, levied property taxes on stocks and bonds and cash. So it's not as though it's never happened. It's not as though there's no precedent. This is a political question. And you would transform the public finances of the United States if you subjected property in the form of stocks and bonds, what's often called intangible property, to the same tax or even a lesser tax than you now apply to tangible property. And all that would mean is making the rich pay a tax on their preferred property form the way we already make middle and lower income people pay on the cars and homes they own. It is a matter of simple tax justice. It is astonishing that I have to report this over and over again so that Americans and others listening will understand one of the basic injustices of the American tax system. The second big topic I want to talk about today, in the time that we have, has to do with the economics of our two major parties in the United States, the Republicans and the Democrats. And I want to do the economic analysis. I'm not going to be talking about their various issues or how they're organized or any of that. I'm interested in the economics of how these parties work. And I think, to get to the punchline of what I'm about to explain, the punchline is that they're quite similar in the broad problem that they have, even though different groups play the assigned role in a similar problem. So let me explain. The Republican Party has long been, and is today, basically run by the largest interest, business interests in the United States, and the wealthiest people. Every poll shows that the preponderant political affiliation of our business community, particularly the big businesses, and of our wealthiest people, is with the Republican Party. And that's a problem, an economic problem. Why? Because the richest companies and the richest people are a small minority in the United States. And a political party that counts on winning millions of people's votes has a real problem if it is basically in the hands of a minority, and in this case, the minority of the biggest businesses and the richest people. In order for them to prevail, and by the way, why do they want to prevail? Because they want the government to support their wealth. They particularly want the government not to do anything that damages or intrudes upon their wealth. That's the political agenda they have. They're doing wonderfully in the economy. That's why they're the richest companies. That's why they're the richest people. Their position in the economy is what they want to preserve. And they enter the political arena. They are interested in politics, and in particular in the Republican Party, because they see that as a vehicle to preserve, to secure, to protect their privileged position in the economy. And their problem is they're too few. All of them voting together, they lose every election. They have got to get allies. They have got to get supporters. They have got to find sizable groups in the political world, in the society, in the country, that they can form an alliance with. And the alliance is basically, we'll do something for you if you vote for our party, you vote Republican. How do they do that? Well, in some cases, they buy the support. For example, earlier today, I spoke about the extraordinary overcharging that companies do with the Defense Department. The largest buyer of goods and services in the government are the military. And they pay wildly overpriced to corporations. Whoa, this is very nice for the corporations. They're very grateful. But of course, for the corporations now, they got to make sure that this continues. So they make a point of having the Republican Party be a very pro-army, pro-navy, pro-military, pro, kind of the gung-ho. You question everything, but not the military. You cut everything, but not the military. The Republican Party is going to make a good support for the military in turn for the military supporting the Republican Party with votes and the military supporting the big businesses with overpriced contracts. There's a nice coming together of the business community and the Republican Party and the government. That was what Dwight David Eisenhower, our president back many years ago, meant when he referred to the military-industrial complex. He could have said the military-industrial Republican complex. Second, support the gun lobby. Support the notion that Americans could and should have guns. Lots of them, carry them around, openly and all the rest, because it creates a bond. It gets masses of people who have no relationship to larger political questions but are really excited about the question of having a gun to think of themselves as Republicans, to see the Republicans as a partner, as a protector, as an advancer of their interests as gun-carrying folk. Churches. To say that the Republicans are going to support the church. It gives them, to make a long story short, a mass base. The Republicans, run and owned by the big businesses and the richest people, can stay in power, can get enough votes to be important, because they get these various groups, and I could add libertarians, and I could add others, the churches, the gun lobbies, the military, who will support and vote for them, because then they can get power. That's what the Republicans have to do. And they always have a problem holding on to their alliances with these groups, which they have to do. And I'll come back to that after we take our short break here in the middle of the program.
Sleep tonight.
Welcome back. This is Richard Wolff. We're in the second half of Economic Update. And I want to remind you again that if you're interested in what we do on these programs, please avail yourself of our two websites that are open 24/7, no charge whatsoever, rdwolff.com, Wolf with two Fs, and democracyatwork.info. Both of them allow you to communicate your thoughts and questions to us, and both of them allow you to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. We were talking about the economics of the political parties, and I had just finished before the break explaining that the Republican Party has this problem. It is, in a sense, the party owned and operated and led by largely big business and the richest folks in America, who are its basic core, but that they're too few in America, so they have to have a mass base. And they do that by building alliances with the military, with gun lobby and sports folks, the churches particularly, libertarians who are anti-government and whom the Republicans cultivate as being the party of little or less government, and so on. They're the ones that appeal to businesses as being anti-union, so they'll protect you against the union, and so forth. Anti-tax, the usual things to get a mass base. The problem is that many of the people they get to vote for them are also deeply suspicious of them. The military wonder whether there's anything going on here other than getting their votes and getting them to overpay for contracts. And they worry that that could come to hurt them in the future. The churches are very skeptical that they're just being used. And they constantly wonder whether the Republican announcement about the church is genuine. In other words, while it's a mass base for the Republicans, there are lots of conflicts. A lot of the working people who want a gun kind of know that the Republican Party is the party of their employer, whom they're not too pleased about in lots of ways. So there's lots of tensions. It's difficult to hold the Republican Party together because of the contradictions and tensions inside it. The irony, and what I want to draw your attention to, is that the same applies to the Democratic Party. It, too, is in the hands chiefly of big businesses and very wealthy people. Take a look at their major donors, take a look at the supports they get from major corporations, and so on. So they, too, have the problem that the people who really run that are a minority. They could not get the votes that they would need to have power, not at the local level, not at the state level, and not at the federal level. They, like their Republican counterparts, have to get a mass base. But here's where the difference comes. They appeal to different people. So the Democrats make deals, the party, with poor people, with union workers and union organizations, with minorities, with women, particularly younger and single women, with the academic community, with the gay community, with those concerned about the environment. These are the different groups that the Democrats try to reach and say, look, we will advance your interests. We will support you. We will protect you, what you're concerned about. But the understanding is you vote for us. That's the deal. And here again, you have the same suspicions. The gay folks wonder, is this just words to get our votes? They're never going to really do anything for us. And the minorities wonder about it. And the poor wonder about it. And the ecology folks, everybody wonders, and they suspect that they're being suckered, that they're being brought in to support something so that they vote for that party, but that party, when push comes to shove, isn't going to do very much for them. And that's always a danger. Why? Because the interests of the rich and the corporations are in many ways different from the interests of the very people they need to keep in the tent if they're going to win the elections. Both parties are therefore fragile. Both parties are therefore full of tensions and conflicts. You see it now being played out in the Republican Party between the Tea Party types and the more mainline traditional Republicans, whose differences are blowing them apart. Senator Cruz is a very different thing from many of the other Republican senators, and the tension there is obvious. And likewise, many in the union movement, for example, are deeply disappointed in the Obama administration for having done so little, they feel, for working unionized workers, given how much money, time, and energy they have devoted. Here's what's important to understand. The major determinant of the outcome of American elections is really the degree to which the two parties can or cannot hold on to the mass base they've crafted over the decades, or whether the tensions between the corporate and wealthy leaders of both parties and the mass base they've cobbled together will blow them apart. If those tensions get more serious inside the Republican Party, the Democrats walk in. And if they become more serious inside the Democratic Party, the Republicans walk in. The winner is the one who can hold on to their base. And the great opportunity for those who are interested in changing American society, changing its politics, would require driving a wedge between the leadership of the Republican Party and its mass base on the one hand, and the leadership of the Democratic Party and its mass base on the other. Imagine if working people, unionists, were able to make an alliance with the churches, an alliance with the libertarians. Suppose the poor were able to be a part of that alliance through their relationship to the churches. Suppose the environment, you see where I'm going. The option politically would be to see what parts of the mass base of the two parties could themselves come together to be a third and different party, a genuinely independent political force. What's important to understand is that if something like that could be crafted, particularly in a time of the tensions exacerbated by the long crisis we're in, the economic crisis, if parts of the mass base of Republicans and Democrats could find a way to be together in a separate party, not only would that make a new party politically powerful, but the exodus of the two parts, one part from the mass base of the Republicans and another part from the mass base of the Democrats, would not only create a powerful third party, but it would do so by severely weakening both of the two traditional parties. And American politics could then open up in a way that many have become unable, I think about. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to spend the time looking at these economic dimensions of our political parties. In the time that remains today, I'm going to respond to questions. A little bit more time than we normally have because our inventory of questions has been rising. I want to thank you, those of you who have sent them in, but also take them seriously and give them a little more time today. Okay, the first. When a corporation leaves a city, I'm going to use as an example General Motors largely, not 100%, but largely leaving Detroit behind and moving car production to places where they can make more profits by paying workers less. When this happens, we don't require in this society, this question sent to me says, we don't require the company to do much. It leaves behind broken lives, lost jobs, workers who can never find another job, or certainly not another one that uses their skill or pays them anywhere near as much. The story is repeated literally tens of thousands of times across the United States in every one of the last umpteen years. And so this question says, is that fair? And explains what this woman who sent me the question meant. She says, by fair, I mean, is it or is it not the case that these large companies have in fact gotten a lot of things from their host city, their host state, the United States government over the years, And wouldn't fairness require that if they leave the places which have given them help in order to make more money, that they at least have some obligations to give back what was given to them, with or without interest, but that they can leave and have no obligation seems unfair, would I comment? Well, it's a very important question, and it's complicated, but I'm going to try to give you an answer. First, it is virtually certain that a large corporation that has been in any community for an extended length of time, 5 years or more, has in fact gotten all kinds of public assistance, costing lots of money. I'm going to go through a few of them just to give you a flavor. One, many a company came in the first place to this or that community, this or that county, this or that state, because they were lured in, they were coaxed in by being given a tax holiday. In other words, they were told, we will give you the first 2 years that you're here, or the first 5 years you're here, you don't have to pay taxes. Now, let's be real clear. That means that this company was given all of the public services that the community and the state provide: road maintenance, fire protection, police protection, education for their employees' children. All of those public expenses were provided to that company and its employees without that company having to pay taxes to help cover the cost, which means the rest of the people in the community had to pay the taxes to provide for the fire department that protected that company, but that company didn't have to pay its tax share for covering those costs. That's a direct gift, a financial support to the company. Number two, in many cases, tax laws were changed, either before a company came or after it came, to give it what's called a tax loophole, to give it a special advantage where the taxes it paid were lower than would otherwise have had to be paid because it was desired to bring that company here, or, very typical, to keep the company because the company let it be known to local politicians that it was thinking perhaps of leaving and would have to leave unless, you know, it were made worthwhile for it to stay. Bingo! The committee of the State House rewrites the law a little bit, and they get a tax loophole. Second kind of help companies get: subsidies, straight-out gifts, a grant, a loan on much cheaper terms from a city or a state than they would have to pay if they went to the bank like everybody else. There might be subsidies of the following form, very typical. If you train young people on the job, we'll pay a portion of the young people's wages for you because of the training you're giving. That's a subsidy. That means that the company doesn't pay the wage a worker gets because the government is picking up part or even all of it. So subsidies to companies, very common, very typical. Very few companies over the life of, if they're large, over the life of a community, of its time in a community, will not have gotten one or another subsidy. And finally, there are the gifts. I don't know what other words to use for them. The gifts that are subtle but crucial. I'm going to, again, just give you a few examples. A company is located someplace, and it has to provide parking for its workers. And it has to rent the land from a nearby landowner and pave over that area so its employees have a place to park. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the local city or state bought a piece of land nearby and created a public parking place where workers could buy a monthly pass, pay a little bit of money to the city, and be able to park their car? That would save a fortune for the company because, in effect, they wouldn't have to privately take care of their workers' parking. The local government would do it, saving the company a pile of money. Is that done? Answer: often. Here's another example. The company has to pay truckers to bring in raw materials. And because of the way the roads in the state work, the truckers charge a good bit of money because they have to take this long, complicated route. Ah, suppose you can go to your state government and you can persuade your governor, who's looking for a hefty financial contribution to his next campaign, that it would be really great if the state highway department upgraded a local unusable road to the quality that would allow big trucks to go over it, because it would lower the cost and shorten the time for trucks to bring crucial inputs to this company. And so that road gets built at public expense, benefiting that company who wanted it built there. That's a support for that government, for that company, that costs the taxpayer plenty. Let me give you another example. Workers have to be paid a higher wage because they're commuting from 10, 20, 30 miles away. Suppose a state or local government builds a whole complex of public housing or provides cheap land to a local private housing developer to develop low-cost housing. Wonderful for the company, because they can lower the housing allowance they give workers, or just lower their wages, and the workers won't mind because they have saved the commuting costs now. They can walk to work, or they can take public transportation to work. It's hard often to prove that the company that benefits paid for this, directly or indirectly. But there is no doubt that with any kind of historical research, you can show how much money a city and a state used that benefited these corporations. So is it possible to say, look, before you leave and destroy the lives and the communities you're abandoning, like GM in Detroit, like Boeing moving from Washington to North Carolina, like a thousand other companies we could talk about, at the very least, you have to pay back the public money you got that you took, that you often requested, and you took to help you. Now that you're leaving, pay back those who helped you succeed. It's the least you could do. Could that be done? Yes. Is it technically able to figure out these costs? Yes. If the company wants to dispute them, bring them before a court, fine. But there's no problem with a community doing this. And my guess is, if you put that up to a vote anywhere in the United States, a community would say, if we're going to shell out our money to help these companies, okay, we're willing. But not under conditions that when they're good and ready to go someplace else, they don't have to give back anything that we gave to them. Final question that we will have time for today. There's a movement in California having to do with California's annual financial report that offers a kind of criticism that I've been asked to comment on and that I want to. And it goes something like this. California government, under Republicans and Democrats alike, justifies that when they have a deficit, that is, when there's less money coming in from taxes than they have to spend to provide the programs that they're in charge of, fire, roads, schools, and so on, that if they don't want to raise taxes on people in general, well, then they're going to have to cut programs. And there are people who look at this situation and say, that's outrageous. The programs you're planning to cut are road maintenance, schools, hospitals. These are things people need and rely on. That's awful. And the criticism comes, and it's been very loud in California, the criticism comes, well, look, the government has enormous assets. If it sold a small portion of those assets, it would get the money that would be required to provide the services we need, and therefore we wouldn't have to cut those services, and we wouldn't have to raise taxes in general. I understand the upset that lies behind this. I agree with the people that these services that the government provides have already been savaged and should not be cut further. They're needed. Last week, I had Dr. Harriet Fraud on the program, and she gave us a graphically, psychologically sophisticated account of what it can mean to people's lives, this endless cutting of government services. But here's my criticism. A, why are we attacking the government? Why should the government sell assets? First of all, many of those assets are themselves part of what the government needs to provide the services, so we would have to worry about that problem. But I'm more concerned about something else. To go after the assets of the government means you're not going after the assets of the tiny proportion in California, as in all the other states, of the richest corporations and citizens in your state. They have done spectacularly over the last 30 years. They've become richer than they ever were at the expense of everybody else. It's time they gave back. It's time they did what they ought to have done all along, pay a larger share of their wealth. It'll still leave them wealthy, but it'll solve the fiscal problems of the state. If we had taxed them all along the way we once did, we wouldn't have had these fiscal problems in the first place. Let's correct it now by going where it's at. Let's go to that before we start taking away assets from a state that is already having difficulty doing what it needs to do. This is Richard Wolff. We've come to the end of another economic update. Thank you very much for spending this time with me, and I look forward to being with you again on Economic Update next week. Gonna be my time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.